Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Last week, Ohio Governor John Kasich rolled out a new two-year bricks and mortar budget for the state, a $2.4 billion plan chock full of funding for local projects. It was the first tip of the state wallet to local projects in 6 years, the first since the Great Recession of 2008. Joining us to talk about that and more in our weekly reporter roundtable is Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Also, Mark Kovac of the Vindicator of Youngstown. Mark, welcome back.
Happy Monday.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome to the show, as usual,
Great
Joe.
Great to be here.
Okay, so before we get to the significance of that capital budget, let's talk about the governor's proposed tax package, which came out a few weeks ago with his budget update that he does every other year. It would cut the income tax and increase the commercial activities tax, the tobacco tax, and establish a new severance tax on shale fracking. His estimates assume a start date of July 1st, but lawmakers are talking about waiting until after the November election. Why the wait, Joe?
Well, that's easy, because there's an election in November. And, you know, if you put that out there now and you start making changes, let's face it, for every tax that's cut, for every change that's made, there's a group that's ticked off about it. So if you lay low and you kind of keep things under wraps right now and don't get people all worked up, then you can get them worked up after they've already elected you in November. So that's kind of why they're, I think that's the obvious reason why they're laying back on it. I also think that when you look at the governor's proposal and what we're likely to see from the legislature, we've already got Speaker Batchelder saying that, you know, he wants to make changes. And we've seen what the track record is with the House and the Senate agreeing on things. Not very good. You know, they all want to change it. So, you know, do you really want to get this big controversial battle, so to speak, going and get changes in place that are solidified before that November election so that people can campaign on them? That's a tough thing.
What's the big bone of contention, Mark Kovac? I mean, what do you think that the governor's proposal is most in conflict with his colleagues in General Assembly?
Business groups aren't supporting some of the main facets of his plan. I mean, take the severance plan. This is the severance tax plan, the oil and gas tax increase. I think it's the third time the governor has offered a frack tax plan. And it's the third time the lawmakers have pretty much smacked it away and gone back to another plan that they've introduced. There are some indications that they're talking behind the scenes, but last time I talked to the head of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association, he told me, you know, we keep coming with our hands out and they're not coming back. They're not talking to us. You know, they're not giving us, you know, they're not giving and taking. So, there's just so much contention on that issue. You take the cap, the commercial activity tax on top of it. Businesses don't like that. We got the cigarette tax issue. And like Joe said, going into an election, I suppose particularly given the whole Medicaid debate and things that happened there, you don't want to tick conservatives off more by coming into an election and saying, hey, you increased our taxes on top of it. So
some smokers do vote. The frack tax, they're saying that his estimates are too high. His administration's estimates are too high. That's one of the reasons why they're saying they want to hold back on that.
And they've said that the previous 2 years that the governor has introduced a severance tax plan. And, there is some truth in that we as a state are very early to the shale drilling field. And it really is a big question mark for a lot of these things, whether they're going to pan out. And if you tie something like an income tax cut, which is a permanent thing, to something that is in flux or declining, like tobacco taxes are, that raises a lot of questions of, is this the most responsible way to cut an income tax?
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. If you have a question or comment about state government or politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513. There is, so they wait until after November, but they're still going to argue about it. It's not necessarily that by waiting after November there won't be conflict.
I don't think they're going to. Was it during the year-ender that the governor told us, you know, I'm going to have this package and some of these things, or maybe it was lawmakers that said, some of these things will get done before the summer recess, some of them will come back and re-examine, and some of them will wait till next year's budget. So I wouldn't be shocked if a lot of this tax stuff waits again till next year, till the next budget cycle.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I think, you know, that they can be pretty fluid. They have the ability right now to kind of make it. Financially, the state is in good shape. And when you've got that situation, you're not having to make any tight curves. You're not having to do anything particularly fast. And, you know, that's a good reason to hold off, you know, for especially going into November.
Well, and a lot of these faces in the General Assembly are going to be the same next year, most likely. You know, there are a lot of elections, a lot of state Senate and House races this November, but the districts are so safe that you can kind of assume already who's going to be returning in January.
Is there anything interesting about covering legislative races anymore?
Oh, I think there are some interesting ones in this cycle. Take Representative Connie Pillich, who's running for state treasurer. She had a tough race last time around, and she's no longer in that race for state house. That's a seat that maybe the Republicans could pick off. I thought Representative Al Landis would have a rougher race this time around. I think he only won from Tuscarawas County.
Okay.
He won by, 17 votes last time or something like that? But from what I'm hearing, that's not going to be as competitive this year as it was last time. So I think there still are some interesting races to keep an eye on.
Yeah. I think there's also some seats that we can count on there, you know, Delaware County, for example. That's one of those well-known areas where, you know your representative's going to be back, your senator's going to be back, because when was the last time a Democrat was elected from there?
Right.
I can't remember.
A very long time it's been. Mm-hmm.
So there, and that's just an example of one area of the state where we know we're going to get a return.
It makes you wonder what that does to voting turnout when it's so fixed, relatively speaking. I mean, it used to be there was a laundry list of races 20, 25 years ago that people were watching all over the state, and it would really adjust the makeup of the House or the Senate or whatever it might be. And now it's one or two, you know, and they're interesting. But are they going to change anything really overall? The Republicans dominate so thoroughly the Ohio General Assembly.
I don't think we're going to see any March Madness type surprises in November.
Wow. And yeah, you want to talk about March Madness?
No, I'd rather not. Not today.
Oh, that's right. You're all from the wrong schools.
Oh, no, I got to say go UD. Yeah, you know, that's great for them.
Yeah, I agree. It's fun. The University of Dayton.
That's right.
So it won't hurt the governor politically if the package isn't done. In fact, it'll probably be better for him if it's not.
I think so.
At least the tax stuff. And the Republicans in the Ohio House split this up into, they introduced, 11 new bills, and there's a couple of extra bills out there that they had heard introduced. And they'll move a bunch of that through. And so they'll have stuff to tell voters, look, we did this, we did this. So
And that stuff will be like higher education and the capital projects. I think that'll get through.
Drug abuse stuff, that'll...
And that's all very, you know, positive with voters. It's all good.
It's all good. What a productive Ohio General Assembly. So now let's turn to that capital budget. It's worth a total of $2.4 billion, more than a half billion increase from 2 years ago. I guess it's 540... I'm sorry, not billion, more than a half... Yeah, half billion, $540 million. Yeah. And it includes about $160 million for local projects. That's probably the biggest change of all, right? The local projects part of it. It used to be, you know, a Christmas tree, they called it, you know, the total pork barrel type of bill, and it hasn't been for a long time. Why is it coming now?
Well, the state, as I said, is in pretty good shape right now. Financially, it's not like it was 4 years ago where the state's having to cut every dime. You know, there's more money to work with. We've seen financial recovery in the state, much like the rest of the nation. And when you have more money to work with, you can do more things. We also have a budget surplus, and we've been able to put a little bit of money inside, actually a lot of money aside, in the rainy day fund. So they have more that they can do. And when you can do things, again, it's an election year.
Still, does $160 million compare with the olden days?
Oh, no, I mean, not at all. But I think by going so long without having such available funds, it's appreciated more. I know when I was a kid and I was in a drought for allowance, and then all of a sudden I got an opportunity to babysit, I was super excited to get that $20 because I, you know, hadn't had it for so long. And I also then was maybe more likely to spend it more wisely. And I think that's also some of the thought behind this. And these projects are, if you look at the list, I mean, it's spread across the entire state. So this is a perfect election year policy move because you're really kind of getting your bang for the buck by spreading it throughout the state and throughout a variety of things from colleges to there's a lot of money for different arts projects. Different arts efforts around the state, which have been struggling since the recession. So it's kind of hitting all different points of the Ohioan demographic.
Yeah. The governor's office sends out quotes from different groups that are supportive of what he's doing regardless. And there was a big spate of them coming out from environmental groups last week. Do you guys remember that? Mm-hmm. What are they so happy about? Do you remember?
Are they happy about state parks, all the funding that's
yeah, there's a lot of funding in this for Clean Ohio, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there's some Clean Ohio money.
And that goes to, you know, turning rejuvenating some state land and public land and making the parks better. So.
Right. Not traditional necessarily advocates for John Kasich, but he's done a really good job of corralling organizations to show support for what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, for sure.
Anything else in the budget that's worth noting, the capital budget, or is it just pretty much the usual boilerplate stuff after that?
It seems pretty boilerplate,
yeah.
You know, and it's a continuation. You know, the governor's going to go out and continue talking about roads and bridges and local projects. So
and all
there's
that.
A continuation of
that. But there's a separate ODOT budget, isn't there?
Yeah, but this, I mean, capital projects and stuff that are in this plan, you know, I think it's just a further, that's a theme you've seen throughout the administration. He's had a turnpike plan. He's had this new bond issue coming up in May. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's another talking point going into an election about how great the state is doing for local people.
And that helps on the campaign trail when you have, you know, five or six different local projects you can pick from to talk to in your stump speech.
Yeah. Ergo, the power of incumbency. We are talking about state government and politics. If you have a question or comment about them, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at AllSides@WOSU.org. Check us out on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jackie Borchardt from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Mark Kovac from the Vindicator of Youngstown. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome, Don.
Yes, a real quick comment basically is in Kentucky, they passed medical marijuana in the Senate and the House, and it's up for the governor's approval. It's very specific. It's just for a particular type of compound found in marijuana and hemp. It's not even the legalization of medical marijuana, but they passed it for testing and to see if this compound, which is Charlotte's Web marijuana, the CBD type, is worth their time. And they did it in 2 weeks, and I wondered why Ohio is having such a hard time. Is Kentucky a lot sicker than Ohio, or is Ohio a lot better than Kentucky? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Don. So, medical marijuana.
The powers that be have pretty much made it clear that this is not something they want to tackle right now, period. We haven't been hearing any statewide elected office holders or any leaders of the legislature come out and say this is a priority for us.
There is a group trying to get it on the ballot,
though. Oh, sure there is, right. Yes. There is a group trying to get it on the ballot. There are proponents of the idea who have been and there are proponents of the idea in the legislature. I mean, Representative Bob Hagan has been for it forever. And we do have those pockets in the legislature, but when you're looking at the leadership, and they're the ones who get to say what what goes through and what doesn't, they're not big on this. We also have seen efforts to put it on the ballot that haven't been successful. And, you know, so that's the issue in Ohio right now.
I think what's interesting, too, is like the caller said, we're seeing other states not doing a full legalization, not even legalizing medical marijuana, but this specific like lower strain of the drug that's been shown to, I guess, help children with epilepsy and some other diseases. So I don't know. You know, Ohio, we've talked about this before on here, tends to do things after 20 or so states.
It's about 23rd to 28.
Yeah, kind of in the middle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the next step. I don't see it happening this year, you know, given all the reasons Joe just said. And again, it's an election year. And I know some of the representatives that I've talked to who might have, you know, voted in favor of a proposal like this firmly believe that the voters should directly decide on something like this, as they have done in other states.
And I think it's going to be interesting as the years go by and we see more and more tax revenue numbers out of Colorado and states that are legalizing, whether that starts to entice some of the lawmakers.
Kind of like the gambling, the casino thing.
Maybe it's time we should tap into that money because that money's leaving our state, you know, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Flocking to Colorado.
But that's got to be years from now, I would think.
So if it does go on the ballot, though, even though polls show that Ohioans, a pretty big majority of Ohioans favor medical marijuana, they're saying that if it actually went on the ballot, they wouldn't necessarily vote for it.
Well, I think it has an uphill battle to get on the ballot.
Yeah.
Because I just don't see it being there because of the signature process, and we've seen it in the past. It has just been they failed to get enough signatures, valid signatures, to get it there. But if they put it on the ballot, you know that there's going to be a spirited debate. There's going to be controversy. There's going to be money coming in from every which way, and when that happens, you're going to take some of these people who maybe support it in theory, and they're going to say, "Well, I don't know. Now that you've raised this issue and that issue, it's hard to tell. That's very fluid."
That's exactly what I was going to say. After, even if it gets on the ballot, there's that whole education period from mm-hmm. that time until Election Day. And I don't know that this group that's trying to put on the ballot has much funding for that piece at all, let alone getting the signatures. And then you're going to have an opposition from somewhere that will probably have a lot more money. And so that's even more of an uphill battle there.
And there's been like, what, 3 or 4 or 5 petition efforts in the past few years, and it seems like we'll have a press conference where one of them will stand up and said, okay, we're certified, this is it, we're ready to go, and then you don't hear anything from them for another year, and then there's another press conference. Okay, we've got a new petition, and then we're certified, and we're ready to go, and then they go away. And I just, you don't hear any real organized effort to get this done.
And I think it goes back to what Jackie just said. There's really no money.
Yeah.
If the you know, powers that be that had the money in this state were backing medical marijuana, it would have a much better chance of getting put into practice. Hmm.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Well, an election year and they're avoiding controversial issues. Why the reintroduction of the heartbeat bill? Is that red meat for the base of the party or what?
Well, I think we've got the red, you know, if you look at who's introducing the heartbeat bill,
which is
Senator Chris Jordan.
And the heartbeat bill itself.
The heartbeat bill is the bill that says when you can detect a heartbeat in a fetus that it cannot be aborted. And many times people argue that a woman could be pregnant and not even know it. And then by the time they discover it, they wouldn't be able to get an abortion. If you look at the heartbeat bill right now, Senator Chris Jordan, Republican out of that safe area we were talking about before in Delaware County, he is the sponsor. But, you know, it doesn't seem to me, and maybe Jackie and Mark can weigh in on this a little bit, but to me, I'm not hearing the lawmakers who were there before coming out to rush to support it this time around either. So I don't know that the will has changed, but I think there is a certain group out of the Republican Party who would love to see this be a campaign issue, and they really want to push it. And by putting it out there again, they accomplish that goal.
You know, Delaware is solid Republican and has been for decades, but is it necessarily a conservative Republican area?
You know,
with the social issues?
You know, I live there and I see mixes of everything. What I do see when I observe, election time, the slate card is all important. That slate card, if you're on that slate card, you're golden. Mm-hmm. Because you can see people going into the polls with that Republican slate card. And I would say in the one day that I sat there, it was the Sunday before the presidential election, there was a Republican Party person out there handing out the slate card. And I think probably half, at least a good half, and probably more, took that slate card in with them.
What do you even need a slate card for if they're saying which party they're on the ballot, unless it's like a judicial race or something like that?
Well, if you didn't study who you're voting for,
Oh, okay. And
you want to, you know, you want to vote for a party, or you want to vote for, you know, that's the way to do it. And, you know, a lot of, especially the down ticket races, a lot of people don't know those people. So, you know, it's like let the party do the work for them because they generally agree with the party.
So the heartbeat bill isn't necessarily controversial because it's probably not going to get much traction.
Yeah. Right. Jordan was the only sponsor in that. None of his Senate colleagues signed on to it, saying that it was a great idea. And, you know, I haven't heard anything from Senate leadership saying that this is going to be a priority for them. You know, the House introduced their version of the heartbeat bill, which is almost it's the same thing that Jordan introduced back in August. And they had, what, 20 or 30 conservative representatives sign on to it. They had a huge press conference. The Duggar family came up. They had, I mean, it was a big spectacle. Right. And after that, nothing. The bill has not had a single hearing. It hasn't really risen to any level of legislative importance. But what you have been hearing is a lot of noise from very pro-life Ohioans in, I think it's the Faith to Action mm-hmm. group that has been pushing this, the heartbeat bill, ever since, you know, that was their idea. And they've been pushing very hard, and they are going to make this an election issue whether or not it moves forward in the General Assembly.
Well, remember last time around, the House is the one that passed the heartbeat bill. It got to the Senate and stalled and didn't mm-hmm. go anywhere. So a heartbeat bill introduced in the Ohio Senate this time, I mean, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that bill's not going anywhere. The other interesting aspect of this is, didn't a judge just strike down Arkansas's heartbeat bill, which is something that the opponents of this bill, many in the pro-life community, say, you know, would happen in Ohio. They would you're putting in
the right to life.
Yeah, you're putting Ohio in jeopardy not only the heartbeat bill, but potentially other abortion restrictions that were put into place.
And, but the pro-heartbeat bill folks want that battle. They want it to go to the court. They want to argue it all the way up to the Supreme Court and to try to, you know, set precedent, overturn Roe v. Wade and Ohio Right to Life and many others who say they are, you know, staunchly pro-life, say that's not really a smart course of action, and it would be expensive for the state and not very fiscally conservative, and they'd probably lose. So,
because the state would be arguing it, the Attorney General's office would be defending it.
Then. Right.
Yeah. Right out of the old taxpayer pockets. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment about state government politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Libertarian Party of Ohio appealed and lost a federal judge's ruling that disqualified gubernatorial candidate Charlie Earle, and I guess the attorney general candidate as well, for the May primary ballot. So where does this stand now? The appeal has now failed. Where are we at now, Joe Ingles?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, right now it looks like the only thing they could do is maybe go over the heads of the court and go to the Supreme Court. But that's probably not going to happen, let's be real. So what they could do is have write-in candidates. But whether they can get the write-in candidates certified, you know, there's another thing. They won't have Libertarian next to their name when it goes on
Even
the ballot.
If you're write-in, there's a process.
Yes,
right.
There is a process, and you have to be certified to be, you know, an actual writing. People write in Mickey Mouse all the time. That doesn't mean that's a legitimate vote in the right. eyes of the law. So
I'm at a loss on the Libertarians. I mean, we went through this bill process last year where the Republicans very quickly moved this bill on minor party candidates to get to the ballot. And during those hearings and throughout that process, we heard from the Libertarian Party about how they were already actively campaigning and gathering signatures, and they were ready to get on the ballot. They passed that bill. The Libertarians challenged it so that they would have the right to get onto the primary ballot. They won that initial battle. And then to think that they couldn't get their act together and just follow the basic requirements to get on the ballot baffles me. After all of that, if they could do all that to get to a place where they could qualify for the ballot, why in the world couldn't they get their act together to get
well,
the petitions?
What are they saying? Do we know?
Well, during the hearing over with there was a hearing officer appointed by Houston to hear this argument about whether they should have put their employer on the petitions, the paid petition circulators, right?
That's the issue.
That was the issue. And during that, there was this email, read. Were you there for this? Mm-hmm. You know, where, I mean, their Libertarian Party people were essentially saying, this is a colossal failure. You know, we haven't been able to get the signatures we need. I don't know what we're going to do at this point. You know, I'm just baffled. Again, to think that you could go through the process and fight your way onto the ballot and then not meet the basic minimum requirement of 500 signatures. I just don't know how you get to that point and not do it.
Well, they did have the signatures, right? It was just that the petition
they
circulators.
They had valid signatures.
Right. They just didn't follow the rule that says that you have to disclose who your employer was. And I think that the petition circulators said that, you know, he had never had to do that before, and he's done it several times, and he considered himself to be an independent contractor. They didn't really work for anybody, even though he was being paid by someone to go and collect them. What I found interesting from this latest ruling last week is that the judge, in his opinion, said that, you know, it's very likely that the Ohio Republican Party did have a hand in this challenge to the Libertarian candidates.
That doesn't have anything to do with the ruling in and of itself.
Right.
They violated that rule.
Right.
About disclosure. Yeah. And so this is a separate thing.
Right. So the judge said, yep, they violated the rule. They're still not on the ballot. But I also want to note, and went out of his way to note, that he believes that, you know, the Republican Party probably had a hand in this because one of the challengers, I think it was for the attorney general, when he was answering questions about his claim, he really didn't understand or show an understanding of the claim he was making. And also the issue came up of who is paying for these attorneys. This is not a cheap thing to do.
So what's the significance if the Republican Party is behind the complaint?
Well, the Libertarians are the potential spoilers for John Kasich,
right,
providing a choice for disgruntled Tea Party people. And
but with the Republicans, if they are behind the complaint, if they are funding it, is that a problem?
Well, I think mostly it's bad PR. I mean, think of how that looks to the public. I think that's it. My question, I don't know, maybe you guys know this, but at election time, could the Libertarians put out a slate card and say, even though our candidates were not recognized with their party affiliation on the ballot, these are our party choices for these offices, and maybe send that around? I think that's legal. And if they did, I mean, that's one way they could possibly get out there with their, you know, letting people know their choices and that sort of thing.
And as far as being a spoiler, Charlie Earle wasn't going to grab more than, 5 to 7 percentage points away. But given the closeness of the race before, that the governor only won by,
Less than two?
It was last time.
Very close.
Listen to. On the other hand, he was running against Ted Strickland, not Ed Fitzgerald. Big difference. So if Earl is not on the ticket, it does make a difference. There are some percentage points in play there that won't be now. But what is he doing otherwise in his race? He seems to be kind of all over there. All over the place on issues.
Charlie Earle?
You mean
Ed Fitzgerald.
Oh.
Do we chalk it up to still being early in the campaign and they're still trying to figure out what they're doing?
It doesn't feel early to me anymore, but...
Ed still has a challenger in the primary.
That's true.
And, you know, honestly, looking at some of the polling that I've seen, there really isn't this huge gap between John Kasich and Ed Fitzgerald. What we are seeing is that the last poll that I can remember seeing had more than 70% saying they didn't know who Ed Fitzgerald was. That's key because John Kasich has a boatload of money in his campaign war chest, and because he has all that money, he can get out and define Ed Fitzgerald for voters before Ed Fitzgerald can afford to define Ed Fitzgerald for voters. So I think, you know, that's right now, that's what we're looking at. It's not that Ed Fitzgerald is far behind or anything like that. It's more that Ed Fitzgerald just doesn't seem to have the elements in play to get ahead that he
money.
Maybe should. Money, support.
Human resources.
Even among Democrats, you see some infighting among Democrats about Ed Fitzgerald and some of the key Democrats who have always been out there leading the charge with money and manpower before are questioning whether Ed Fitzgerald was the right pick. So, you know, all those issues, it'll be interesting to see in the coming months how the Democratic Party lines in with Ed Fitzgerald and what they provide him. If the money comes up seriously, or if this is, you know, we had some races where the Democrats weren't competitive at all in the gubernatorial race. Rob Birch.
Comes to mind right away.
Right away.
I don't think it's ever been worse than that.
I don't think it ever has. And I don't think, you know, this would have to, you know, I'm not saying that by any means Ed Fitzgerald equates to Rob Birch in any way. But I'm saying that the Democrats could decide, hey, you know what, we really don't want to invest everything in this race. Let's, you know, put more investment in this and this and this. So
Rob Birch was the Democratic state senator who ran against George Voinovich during when he was running for re-election.
Correct.
It was a huge mudslide.
Yes.
Unbelievable debacle.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob Birch has never really been heard much from.
I tried to get hold of him. I wanted to do a Where Are They Now piece. And I've tried to find him. He is very elusive. I can't find him anywhere. So, I mean, maybe some other people have had a better...
Maybe he's listening right now. And
if he is
up,
listening, call my office, Rob Birch. I'd love to do an interview with you.
I remember him well. We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests this hour, Jackie Borchardt of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Mark Kovac of the Vindicator from Youngstown, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. If you have a question or comment about state government or politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I just have a comment and a question. It's about the card that you get from whichever party you've been voting for. During the midterm elections and also, particularly in the midterm elections, there's little to no information given to you about judges or positions for judges. And they don't put, like, if you're lucky, the party will put one or two names down on there, and then I get into the boat. Then I get into the booth. I'm like, who are these people?
There's someone you can trust. Is what always comes to my mind.
I hope
you can trust.
So, but I would like. I mean, I don't know. You know, the difference between judge number one and judge number four, and juvenile, you know, and there's been a lot of problems with the juvenile justice system lately. And then, you know, I mean, I didn't realize I had to bone up for a test to be a citizen. I'm sorry to make it sound that way, but they're the most important people. I think they're some of the most important people.
Well, I think that former, the late Tom Moyer of the Ohio Supreme Court, former Chief Justice, would agree with you. He was one of his greatest concerns was the issue of the judicial ballot.
Mm-hmm.
but there's not been much change, right, Joe?
Right. And, you know, this is one of the things that the people who want merit selection for judges versus elections for judges, this is one of the main things they bring up, that voters often vote on name recognition. They vote, you know, for a variety of reasons other than this is the person whose philosophy they agree with. And, you know, really, how much can the judicial candidate, how much can they actually say?
They can't.
They really can't say much about themselves.
Without biasing themselves in the future.
So what you basically have to do when you go in to vote for a judge, you have to be pretty well read. You have to know from the newspaper, from reading cases and different things that have happened, where those judges have stood, maybe things that have happened along the way. It's not easy.
Maybe nothing's happened.
Yes,
though.
Or maybe nothing. Yes. And so, you know, that is one of those areas where, as she says, you have to do homework in order to be able to make a vote on it in the way that you want to vote on it. So
I think the Ohio Supreme Court races this year present Democrats with potentially their best chance of winning a statewide office.
Tell us.
Because they have a judge named O'Donnell,
mm-hmm.
who's a Democrat, going up against Judy French, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I think, like this caller, there's going to be a whole lot of people who go into the ballot box not knowing anything about these judges. They're going to see the name O'Donnell, and they're going to think maybe it's Terrence O'Donnell, the Republican who's already sitting on the court. I think his name alone gives him an edge. And that's what, if you looked at the last Supreme Court election, we had O'Neill and Kennedy win. Mm-hmm. I mean, arguably based on their names.
Which are Irish.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's just say it. Is there something about an Irish judge that is appealing to Ohio voters?
Those names have always been popular with judicial candidates. I think this poses a nightmare for reporters because I can't imagine trying to cover a Supreme Court story with two O'Donnells on the. No. That's going to be major confusing if. You know, but that's you know, kind of
not
a joke
that there's
there,
massive
but.
Coverage of the Ohio Supreme Court.
That's
on
true.
The other hand.
That's true. But I think Mark raises a really good point there, that the name recognition is what people go for.
You know, and the exception on the races was Bill O'Neill last time around, who didn't have any problem. Usually you ask a judge candidate, what do you think of the death penalty? What do you think about this? And they'll say, oh, I may have to decide on that later. I'm not really going to say anything about it. I'm going to, you know, decide it fairly, blah, blah, blah. Bill O'Neill, I mean, I remember people asking him during panels, what do you think of school funding? Well, I think it's unconstitutional, blah, you know, and he wasn't afraid to give his opinion. I don't know if that helped him get elected or not more than his name. But there are instances where judges will give their opinion on things, certain ones. But people are so tuned out and there's no party label in the general election.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it matters.
The lack of party label probably.
Right.
And the lack of a political campaign, too.
Right.
You know, you can't have I just remember the campaign ads from the last election. And they're, you know, they don't go negative. They don't really tell you anything.
Well, they can go negative. They did go negative a few years back against
Alice Resnick.
Alice Resnick out of Toledo.
And that was nasty.
She had been on the court for many years and was just thrashed.
Yeah.
And she won.
She did win. I think that name recognition kind of helped her.
Right.
But if a judge candidate goes negative, it really reflects poorly on that candidates,
but it was
a campaign.
I think it was not necessarily them.
It was an outside group.
Right.
It was the Chamber of Commerce that had come
That's
in
right.
and basically fronted a lot of money for that campaign.
All right. Beth, thanks a lot for that call. Now we have a few people calling in with some ideas about how to learn more about candidates. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Yes, I find it great help to be the League of Women Voters, and you can find the local one online, and they'll have the different candidates get a chance to give a couple of 100, 300 words, whatever, about who they are, what their issues are, how they feel about things. And sometimes you're trying to, I mean, of course, everyone wants to sell themselves. You have to read the tea leaves and kind of read between the lines. But you can get some great information there on just about everybody and every issue. And then I just decide, make my decisions, put it on a slip of paper, put it in my pocket. And then when I'm in the voting booth and I have these issue, and names, I can just, Judge so-and-so, yep. Issue such and such, no. Clerk of County Courts, this person. It's a great help.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot for that suggestion. And thanks for doing your homework. Ann in Clintonville, you have another idea. Hi, Ann.
Hi there. I've found one of the best tools is to go to the Columbus Bar Association's rating charts for the judges. They have various categories such as knowledge, fairness, objectivity, how the court is conducted, and so forth, so that you can go right down and get a sense of how these judges are rated by several thousand of the trial lawyers who actually appear in their courts and work with them.
Ann, could I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you pay attention to newspaper editorials? Okay.
Yeah, well, I read them, but I always feel like there's a certain bias in them, so I'm waiting for some more objective information. And also, there are various groups around the community, I wanted to add, that have candidates' nights, and one of them is the judges' nights. And when the judges come, I really recommend you come and listen to them, because when they're given 5 minutes on the platform, you kind of get a sense of where they're coming from and what their philosophy is, and you get to meet them in person. So
that's a good point. The Franklin County Consortium on Good Government they are just dogged in getting those candidate nights together, issue nights. I've moderated many of them over the years, and there's never enough people. We could just use so many more people, because the more people that are there, the more interesting it becomes. Right. Ann, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You know, on the Bar Association thing, though, the last time around, the two candidates who won Supreme Court justice had lower rankings on the Bar Association list than the two
which
who lost.
Suggests that people are not looking at the rankings, or not, if they are, which I would imagine they are. And I think those were two good ideas for doing some research with some organizations who have to stand behind what they're doing. And the rankings are based on, with the Bar Association, they put a lot of thought into those.
Yeah.
A death row inmate wanted to donate his organs to some family members before he is executed. They've just turned him down on that. Let's talk about that for a minute. Mark Kovac,
Ronald Phillips was supposed to be executed in November. He had asked prison officials if he could donate organs to his mom and sister and maybe other people. The prison folks turned him down initially. But the governor issued a stay through July to give him a chance to, figure this out if you can do it. Last week, the prison officials sent his attorney a letter saying, look, your mom's not on the list or whatever. You haven't gone through the things that you need to go through to set this up. There's really not enough time for you to do this at this point. So we're not going to give you permission if you haven't donated your organs by, I think it was yesterday. And we fully intend to execute you on July 2nd. So that's kind of where things stand. It was an interesting approach. It's the first time I've heard of an Ohio death row inmate asking to donate his organs like that. I'm surprised more inmates aren't trying to do that. But it's an interesting case, but it looks like he's headed toward execution in July, pending, the whole other issue about how Ohio executes his inmates and the review of Dennis McGuire and how that execution went down. There's a lot of whole lot of other issues in that mix. But as of right now, I don't think Ronald Phillips is going to get permission to donate his organs.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it's kind of interesting that the sense was that he needed time to recuperate. That was why you haven't done it by now. You won't have time to recuperate and heal before the execution.
You can be fully alive.
Yeah, we want you fully, there and, during the execution. We don't want your health to be compromised during the execution.
Remember,
you healthy.
Remember Lawrence Reynolds back in 2010, the day or so before he was supposed to be sent down to Lucasville for his execution, he tried to commit suicide. And in his case, they brought him back
That's
to
right.
life and kept him healthy enough for a couple weeks so that they could take him back down and kill him properly. So it's somewhat similar there. You need time to recuperate so that they can put you to death the right way.
It's just odd. I think to most people, when you hear that, you kind of go, what?
The way the ruling went, though, the way they said you won't have enough time to recuperate does suggest that they've set a precedent. Now they're saying, well, you could do this, but you have to do it within a certain amount of time. So, Jackie, any predictions there for people?
I mean, he did get to delay his execution quite a bit of time. And like Mark said, I'm surprised that more haven't tried to do it for that reason, to try and delay things. This was an interesting situation in that he actually did have a possible from what I understand, his mother has kidney disease, so he did have a possible donor. But the fact that no real action has been taken to go through that process shows that maybe it wasn't his primary motivation to actually help.
Or maybe it shows that it's not that easy to transplant an organ to somebody, and maybe there just isn't enough time unless you start a year, 2 years out in the process, not a week or two before you're supposed to be executed.
Well, people donate organs all the time.
Yeah, but there's an organ donation process too, mm-hmm. and I think part of the issue was his mother was not in that process like maybe other people were, mm-hmm. and so therefore that makes a big difference. I mean, usually there's a list and there's extensive testing and matching and all of these things that take place, and that hadn't taken place in this case.
And the issue of people are out there, perhaps some people out there wondering, well, why don't inmates donate organs? Why wouldn't they? There's such a huge waiting list for so many organs, but there's an ethical issue there, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. You know, obviously, when you're putting someone to death with poison in their body, the organs are not going to be good after the fact. So that would have to happen before. But we've never had that case in Ohio, and I'm not sure that we've ever had it in the country either. I don't know. So that could be, you know, there could be a big case, you know, federal case on this, actually, at some point, and we could have this debated properly in court. But right now, it doesn't look good for Mr. Phillips.
Email from John. Well, first email from Jason. He said, I saw a piece that the Inspector General, the Ohio Inspector General, was told about a hit list at the Department of Education, but the interview of the person who gave him that information disappeared from the IG's file. Did the IG give any explanation for this? It seems suspicious. Anybody?
I saw an email on that, but I did not cover that last week.
Okay.
I don't think anyone has actually followed up on that.
I have followed up halfway on that story, but I don't feel like I can comment on it right now because I need to get more information before I can put it out there.
Email from John. Ask Mark to talk about the suit the judges brought against the city of Youngstown to fund a new courthouse.
Oh, that was interesting. There was 3 days of hearings last week. The municipal judges sued the city. They sued years ago, 2007, 2009, because their municipal court sounds like it's just in deplorable condition, doesn't have enough furniture, doesn't have the right heating and air conditioning, all this stuff. And so they were down last week. I sat through 6 or 7 hours of hearing through witnesses of that. So it's in a hearing officer's hands to determine whether what to do next. The judges want Youngstown to follow one course of action and do I think it's an $8 million remodel. The city wants to do another course of action. I think it's a $6 million remodel. There's a lot of conflicting ideas of what needs to be done there. It's in a hearing officer's hands, and the Supreme Court will have to make a decision on that. It was interesting, but it was a long day, the one day I was there. So,
well, yeah, I can imagine. Anything looking forward this week? What are you guys going to be covering?
Hang on, Sloopy.
Oh, that's right.
Big vote coming up.
Big vote
and
on
that
Sloopy.
Would be the state fight song?
Official state rock song, which
rock
everybody thought
song.
It already was, but it
tried
wasn't apparently.
This
for goodness sake.
It was okayed as a resolution, but not put into Ohio revised code. So now it's on the fast track.
And someone actually did get up.
I was in that committee hearing for the first hearing 2 weeks ago, and a lawmaker stood up and tried to sing it, wasn't really familiar with the song.
Well, who is? I mean,
it was a very interesting moment in statehouse history. So,
yeah, well, they've done things like that on the floor, not just in committee.
Yeah,
so.
I'm hoping that it comes up at the floor. Maybe they roll out like one of those karaoke carts.
Oh, jeez.
That would be incredible.
It would be.
So we're all out. We wait with bated breath on Hang on, Sloopy. And what else?
Governor signing Calamity Days, I think, this week.
Snow Day
bill finally putting that case
expecting
to rest.
Expecting an inch tomorrow could shut down the entire city again, so
not
it couldn't
again.
Come sooner.
What else is up for a vote? Capital budget, I think, is slated for a vote this week. That's on a fast track. They want to have it signed by next week, I think. So.
That is
and
fast.
We'll be hearing on all the other pieces of the Kasich's proposals this week, too.
Well, thanks for joining us today. Jackie Borchardt, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Mark Kovac of The Vindicator from Youngstown. Thanks, Mark.
Have a good week.
And thanks for manning that hearing
there.
For
Anytime.
6 or 7 hours.
Anytime.
Wow. And Joe Engel of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.